We'll go on the record and come to order. The commission is hereby convened in open session on Thursday, October 22nd, 2020, to consider the matter entitled Secretary of Labor versus Consol Pennsylvania Coal Company, LLC, docket number PENN 2019-0008. Present are me, Marco Rakovich, Chair of the Commission, Commissioner Alton, and Commissioner Traynor. And for the record, and due to our protocol for continuity of operations and for our COVID-19 response, all commissioners and commission counsel are appearing today by electronic video and audio. So if any participants lose their electronic connection, we'll stop the proceedings until you're reconnected. And we'll start with an overview of the case presented by Rory Smith. So Rory, you have the floor.
Good morning. The commission has directed review of the issues raised in a petition for review filed by the Consol Pennsylvania Coal Company concerning docket number PEN 2019-8. Consol seeks review of the judge's finding that it violated the requirements of the safety standard at 30 CFR section 75.517. Specifically, that standard requires power cables to be insulated adequately and fully protected. In addition, Consol raises the issue of whether the judge erred in finding that the violation was significant, substantial, and the result of moderate negligence. Proceeding concerns a citation issued on August 26, 2018 by MSHA Inspector Brian Yates. Yates issued the citation after observing the condition of a power cable connecting the power center to a feeder at Consol's Enlow Fork Mine, an underground coal mine in Pennsylvania. Yates observed the cable hanging loose from hooks secured to the roof in an entry. Yates had Daniel Colby, Consol's safety inspector, lock and tag the cable out of service. Yates then slid his hands over the cable, feeling for bumps, tapping, and twisting it. Yates later testified that he located two damaged spots on the cable. The first, a 3/4 inch cut in the outer insulation, and the second was a 1 3/4 inch of a cut in the outer insulation with a damaged inner conductor. Yates believed that the violation likely existed at the time of the last pre-shift examination based on the amount of coal and rock dust he found inside of the cuts. Accordingly, he designated the violation to be due to a moderate degree of negligence. Yates also designated the citation as significant and substantial. He was concerned that a miner would come into contact with 480 volts of electricity and receive a fatal injury. Miners travel on foot and in vehicles through the entry. Furthermore, the feeder is trammable. It is moved while energized with the miner handling the cable. Colby testified that he initially didn't see any issues with the cable when it was hanging in the entry. Yates demonstrated the damaged area to Colby. Colby agreed that one of the cuts was deep with damaged conductors. In his opinion, the requirements of the safety standard were violated. Colby also testified that he believed that Yates' vigorous inspection techniques, including his alleged use of a screwdriver to clean the cable, may have damaged the cable. Travis Stout, Consol's general maintenance foreman, testified that an electrical examination performed on August 25th demonstrated that the cable's ground fault protection system was working properly. He believes that if the conductor had been damaged prior to the entry inspection, the sensitive ground fault protection would have tripped the circuit breaker and powered down the feeder. On December 30th, 2019, the judge issued a written decision concluding that Consol violated the safety standard. The judge credited Yates' testimony, noting that Colby corroborated some elements. The judge also affirmed the significant and substantial designation. He found that the violation contributed to the hazard of a miner contacting an inadequately insulated power cable. There was a reasonable likelihood of the occurrence of the hazard during continued normal mining operations and a resulting serious injury or death. The judge also found that the cable was likely in a similar condition at the time of the last pre-shift examination, and accordingly, Consol exhibited a moderate degree of negligence. The judge assessed a civil penalty of $2,487. On review, Consol argues that these findings are not supported by substantial evidence. Yates' testimony was inconsistent, and therefore the judge erred in relying on it. Consol argues that the record compels the conclusion that Yates created the violative conditions at issue. Additionally, Consol argues that its sensitive ground fault protection would have prevented the operation of the feeder if the cable was in fact damaged when it was operating. With respect to the judge's S&S analysis, Consol argues that the judge erred when he failed to consider the cable's ground fault protection as mitigating evidence. Finally, Consol argues that the judge erred in his negligence analysis. In contrast, the secretary maintains that the judge's findings are supported by substantial evidence in the record, and his analysis is consistent with the law. I can now take any questions you may have.
Okay. Anything for Roy? Okay, well, thank you very much, Roy. And again, before we get into, I'm sure everybody's going to probably echo this, but excellent analysis, excellent presentation, and it was very helpful to me, your memo was. Commissioner Alton has volunteered to speak first, so Commissioner Alton.
Thank you, Chairman. And Rory, I do want to echo the chairman and thank you for your memorandum, which, as always, was excellent. It was a good analysis of the law. It was very clearly written and expressed a classic understanding of the law. Nevertheless, I may have to disagree with some of the results, although I'm still thinking very seriously about this case and look forward to hearing my colleagues. I was struck particularly by the part of the judge's decision about the conduct of Inspector Yates. He says, quote, "This court understands that Yates' personality and zealotry have raised antipathy and suspicion on the part of respondents. However, having considered all the evidence in toto, this court rejects respondents' arguments that Yates deliberately or recklessly damaged the cable so as to have self-created the violation and then having given perjured testimony. There may have been some inconsistencies and self-serving exaggeration in Yates' testimony, but this court neither finds Yates to be fundamentally a mendacious individual, nor did it observe any instances where Yates engaged in fabrications." And I'm not going to contradict that. However, because I don't know that we can say that he perjured himself or deliberately engaged in fabrications. However, on the whole, his conduct here as an inspector is very, very regrettable. And there's no question he manipulated the evidence before the mine representative who was with him had an actual opportunity to observe the condition. He used a small screwdriver to clean out the hole, prying it to open, and then he twisted the cable. He himself testified he tapped it with a stick, therefore directly distorting the cable itself, both by hitting it, prying at it, and twisting it, before the mine representative actually had a clear look at the area with which he was concerned. But he went beyond that. He took a picture of the violation, the supposed violation, but he took it after he'd done all this and cleaned it out. And that picture is clearly demonstrated by the evidence to be a gross distortion of the violation because it's taken up so close, or in some way so close, that it's made to look much larger than it would have looked had an actual picture been taken with the tape next to it. And then finally, he took a picture to show the height of the ceiling in a different area of the mine. He took a picture to show the height of the ceiling in an area where the roof was lower. I give Inspector Yates an attaboy for being a very zealous inspector, but you know, there are signs up on mine walls that say one aw shucks wipes out 1,000 attaboys. And there's at least 4 or 5 aw shucks in the conduct of this inspector that cast real doubt on what the condition of the cable was, if any. There may have been bumps. He said he felt bumps when he was hand over hand checking it. May have been bumps there, but not cuts. We just don't know until he manipulated the cable. So I'm inclined, but not finally decided. There's a Latin maxim. Forgive me, it's been a long time since Jesuit high school, so my Latin may not be great. But there's a Latin maxim that says, "Omnia presumptor contra spoliatorum," which means all presumptions are against one who wrongfully disposes of the evidence. And it allows, the spoliation of evidence allows an inference to be drawn against a party who manipulates the evidence in a way that it's not clear whether it's actually good evidence or not. And I think the inspector did that in this case. He clearly did it. The judge says there was no evidence introduced to show that twisting a cable could open could open any cut that was in it. Well, that's, you don't need evidence of that. Anybody who's ever tried to open a bottle knows that you twisting a cable will do things to what you're twisting. And the use of a screwdriver, it also irritated me, although irritation is not a reason to reach a legal judgment, of course, but when the company's lawyer asked, it was only after you brought the cable down, cleaned it out, tapped on it, twisted it around, that you saw what you're contending is a damaged interconductor. Instead of just answering the question, the inspector, in a rather surly response, says, well, I can't tell the craters on the moon. I can't see the craters on the moon either. So it's an inspector with a bad attitude and bad conduct. And I think in order to hold inspectors to proper conduct and to proper inspections and to allow mine representatives to have a actual view of the evidence before it's been changed, and then to get actual photos of what the evidence really looked like before it's been changed, the proper course here would declare no violation and draw the inferences against the government due to the inspector's misconduct. I shouldn't say misconduct. I'm not saying he's a liar or they deliberately did anything, but it's clear he was a little over-eager and nobody got a chance to see this alleged violation until after he dealt with it. Colby did testify he saw some distortions on the cable. Doesn't say there was cuts. So the inspector actually clearly made the violative condition, if any, worse before he showed it to anybody. And then he got up and through his testimony, as the judge says, clearly was zealous and overemphasizing and exaggerating. I think the government needs to be held to account for the misconduct of its inspectors. I think this Inspector Yates, on this occasion, clearly engaged in not deliberate misconduct, not criminal conduct, nothing like that, but engaged in conduct which changed the nature of the scene so that a case could not be fairly presented before the commission. Therefore, I'm inclined to just draw an inference against the inspector's testimony and find no violation. I'm not sure my colleagues, there may be surprised by hearing that. I'm not expecting them to necessarily, hey boy, you're right on. So they may go on to other grounds. If it needs be, and they may convince me that we can't draw the same, they may think the inspector did a great job here. Everything he does with Apple, it's okay to twist the cable. It's fine to pick at it with your screwdriver. You can wash it off. You can hit it with a stick. You can do all that before you show it to the mine representative. Maybe they'll say, that's cool, that's great, that's all fine. And in that case, when it finally was shown to Colby, it was a violation. The picture we have shows a violation no matter how distorted it is, although clearly distorted. So I guess I'd find a violation. But I don't see a basis to find negligence here. The inspector did testify that, well, he thought you should hand over hand check the cable. I guess he means that what he would do is when he's inspecting the cable on the weekly examination, he would go hand over hand the full length of the cable all the way from the power outlet power all the way out to the feeder. I don't believe that. Yes, I'm checking his credibility on that. He did hand over hand here a little bit. And this is on 7 to 8 feet high, locked insulated cables. It's hard for me to conceive that he really meant that an inspector every week is going to be going down that whole length of that cable like that. In any event, he said that, what he do? He did not say that's what a reasonable person would do. There's no evidence that that's the way a reasonable person would conduct the weekly examination of this cable. And I would just be loath to hold that by finding negligence here that we think that that's the way every inspection has to be conducted in every mine in the country, that everybody has to go and be out and feeling the length of the cable or they're negligent. I can't conceive of that. So I would not find negligence here. And you know, somebody may say, well, how can you have a violation with no negligence? Well, if you have a violation, it's a strict liability standard. You don't need to be negligent to have a violation. That's well established. And we've held cases where there's no negligence, but a violation. And unless somebody failed to act like a reasonably prudent person under the same or similar circumstances, they were not negligent. I don't see the evidence that the inspection conducted the day before was not done as a reasonably prudent person would under the same or similar circumstances, which is buttressed by the fact that the inspector did not, this zealous inspector did not cite them for an inadequate inspection. If they did an inadequate inspection, then they failed to inspect them. They should have got a citation for that too. So I simply cannot see negligence here. With regard to the significant and substantial, there I'm very firm that his misconduct destroys any possibility of finding significant and substantial here. We have no idea what that table actually looked like before he engaged in it. And by misconduct, I'm not condemning the inspector, and I'm not saying deliberate misconduct. I'm just saying inspectors can't manipulate the evidence, and he clearly did, and then he presented essentially testimony based upon manipulated evidence. And I cannot find an S&S based upon manipulated evidence. Thank you.
Okay, Commissioner Traynor.
Thank you, Marco. Thank you, Rory, for an excellent memo. It was very helpful, and I didn't have trouble agreeing with its conclusions. I think it was pretty straightforward. I think this is a substantial evidence case. I think I could have found under the circumstances high negligence, and so I can easily affirm the judge's finding of moderate negligence. And I guess I'll start there. It's my understanding the cable was hanging from its guide or the railing that it's normally attached to. And this was in an area that was frequently traveled by miners on foot or in vehicles. And there was some thought that perhaps this area where the cable had been dislodged from its railing was an indication that a vehicle loaded with coal may have come into contact with the cable. And I think that's why the inspector knew to check it thoroughly, doing this hand-over-hand check of the cable, which he testifies is necessary to find these smaller, the smaller items of damage to these cables. So I think that when the inspector, I think that's an important background fact, not that, I didn't see anything in the record about the inspector checking every bit of cable and every cable in this same hand over hand manner, running his hand along the cable to check the shielding. I understood his examination hand over hand as being limited to the area where it seemed there had been some contact with the cable and the cable had come dislodged. I also note that the record states and the inspector testified that Consol was already on notice for having violated this standard multiple times in the recent past. I'm sorry, I don't have available at my fingertips the actual numbers as to how many citations were issued and when, but I did see that the inspector testified that this is a recurring problem at the mine. And that's where I could find high negligence. I think it seems that Consol disregarded the fact that there was this repeat problem and didn't take the steps itself to examine this cable for damage, even though this inspector, through his zealous undertaking of his job, had found numerous similar violations and had put Consol on notice that there was a problem. So I think moderate negligence, even if there were some mitigating factors, for instance, the ground fault, which we can talk about later, even if there were mitigating factors, I think moderate negligence would still be supported and is supported by substantial evidence here. Going back to this issue of evidence spoliation, I would want to look at, and I haven't looked before today's meeting on exactly what standards you would need to meet in order to demonstrate that there was spoliation and that it was of the type or degree that would support drawing an inference, an evidentiary inference. So I can't, even if I accepted all the facts as my colleague Commissioner Alton laid them out, I'm just not sure about a spoliation conclusion. And I'm sure we can have some additional either conversation or maybe exchanges as we're writing, and we can look at some of that case law. But turning to the events and the particular facts that Commissioner Alton suggests should give rise to a spoliation inference, I'm not sure, I don't believe that Commissioner Alton repeated those facts the same way that I understand them after reviewing the memo and the record. It's my understanding that when he saw the cable hanging, the inspector began his search for cuts or any other damage to the cable by going hand over hand, as he testified, and that he may have twisted as well. But the additional steps of prying with a screwdriver and tapping with his walking stick, apparently to dislodge coal dust that had accumulated, it's my understanding that those two things occurred after the inspector showed Colby, Consol's safety representative, the damage that he had identified. So the only things, as far as, I'm pretty sure, and I would want to check the record a little more closely, because you understand, Commissioner Alton, this is the first time I hear your thoughts on this. So,
of course.
I'll look as closely as I would have, but it's my recollection that all he did was rub his hand along the wire searching for cuts or deformations, and he twisted the wire, but that's all he did before he showed Colby that there were cuts to the external jacket and in one place, and then there was a cut to the external jacket that also had damaged the internal conductors. It's my understanding that he showed Colby the conditions of the cable before he took a screwdriver to it, that it was subsequent. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, Colby even acknowledged that there was damage to the cable at that point. But then subsequently, the inspector did some additional things to the cable, including, as he testified, tapping it with a stick to dislodge coal and apparently using a screwdriver to try to remove accumulated coal from the area that had been cut. That was done afterward, and that was done while Colby couldn't directly observe what he was doing, which is why you don't have any testimony in the record that the inspector actually damaged the cable. Colby didn't see that happen, didn't testify that he saw that happen. That's really speculation on his part. I'll have to dig into the facts a little more closely to make sure I understand them correctly. But at this point, the way I read them, my first go through before the meeting, is that the inspector found damage to the cable before he did any kind of manipulation that could have further damaged the cable, and that the company had acknowledged there was damage to the cable. Now, it's also, I saw elsewhere in the record testimony that was, as far as I could tell, again, uncontroverted testimony, that even a pinhole size cut to the outer jacket, the outer insulating jacket, without damage to the inner conductors, presented a threat of electrocution. And I think this threat is especially significant given the fact that this power cable was in an area, again, that was heavily traveled. It was an area that was wet. It could be expected that a miner would try to rehang the cable back to the guide using his hands, and that could have presented an opportunity for electrocution. Also troubling was the fact that this cable from the power center to the, it was a feeder, I believe, a feeder belt, was sometimes handled by miners in the ordinary course of mining when the, I believe a portion of the feeder belt was trammed through this area. So that, in other words, again, I don't have all the particular detail and I apologize, but I understand that this cable would be handled while equipment that was powered by this cable would be moving periodically during the ordinary course of mining. And so that, you know, I don't have a hard time coming to the conclusion that a miner would come into contact with this cable, which was damaged to some point, to some degree, and to a degree that we have uncontroverted testimony would present a risk of electrocution. So that's my understanding of the facts. And once you take those facts, that there was a risk of electrocution, that it did seem reasonably likely that that hazard could cause an injury, and that miners would actually, you know, there was a reasonable likelihood that miners would come into contact with the cable and give rise to the possibility of electrocution. all these facts together allow me to relatively easily affirm the finding of SNS. I would find that the ground fault protection, the GFI protection that they had there, shouldn't be considered because it's a redundant safety measure. But even if you don't consider it a redundant safety measure, when you're looking at it either in the SNS context or in negligence, I think our case law directs us to focus at the nature of the violation. For instance, in negligence, you look to the nature of the violation, not to whether you consider mitigation, but you don't let the company off the hook because it had a backup, it was negligent committing the violation, and the fact that there may have been some backup system that mitigated that negligence is simply mitigation. It's not what you would use to find the basis of no negligence. Because they did negligently fail to carry out their duty to inspect these cables and ensure that these cables were fully shielded. Going to the underlying, again, switching away from the law, where I would, consider how, look at where I would take instruction from the law as to how we should consider in the context of negligence or in the context of SNS, the ground fault interrupt system, and moving toward the facts about the ground fault interrupt system, I saw from the record no evidence that the ground fault system would protect a miner from electrocution. So if a miner, by touching the cable, had provided the ground that would have tripped the GFI protection, I think, if I'm not mistaken, that even Consol's witness acknowledged that the miner could have, he wasn't aware, he didn't know whether the miner could have been injured when providing that ground, even if the GFI system then kicked in. So he would provide, the miner, by grabbing that cable, touching the ground, wet ground, would have provided the ground that would have tripped the ground fault system and would have eventually turned off, would have broken the circuit and turned off the power. But I don't know what amount of electricity would have surged through that miner's body to create that ground. And neither did Consol's witness. But I do believe there was testimony from the inspector, and you'll have to take this last thing I'm about to say with a grain of salt, because I'd even want to go back to confirm this in the record. I do believe there's testimony from the inspector that scenario would have produced some injury. What I'm certain of is that Consol's witness testified that he couldn't say whether that scenario would produce an injury. So even on the facts, I don't know that we can, looking just at the facts and not at the law, that counsels us to compartmentalize these mitigating and redundant safety measures. Even just looking at the facts of it, I'm not sure that the GFI system did provide adequate protection to prevent injury. So those are some of the issues. I think I've addressed most of the issues that my colleague Commissioner Alton spoke to. And then the ground fault issue, which I saw as relatively salient, something I looked at a little bit closely when deciding to affirm. But that is where I've ended up. I think I could affirm the judge and his decision in its entirety. I do acknowledge, as Rory's memo does, that the judge made some errors in reciting some of the evidence. And we should, I think, note those errors, but I don't believe they affect his analysis or his conclusions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner. Well, the focus on evidence drives all these reviews that we're into. And of course, let me back up and just reiterate our standard review, substantial evidence. And that's what everybody's talked about here. And that's the evidence here that the parties have put forth, do they support the judge's findings? And again, as we're continually reminding ourselves, it's not how we would decide that case individually. It's whether the judge, based on what was put in front of him, how he decided it, and was there a basis for that? So again, the issue in this case, and we've all talked about it here, we've all heard about it, is it a violation? If it is it SNS? And then what is the level of negligence here? I think it's important to key in on the language of the regulation that was cited here. 30 CFR 75517 mandates that power wires and cables be insulated adequately and fully protected. That's what it says. I think it's important, as we have already talked about here, to focus on the evidence at the scene. Now, to me, what appears to have brought this situation...
Marco, we're not hearing you.
I'm breaking up on you?
Yes.
Oh, you're not hearing me?
Well, you are breaking up. That's why we weren't hearing you.
Okay, all right.
But only as of about 2 minutes ago, you were starting to say we need to look at the evidence, and then you started breaking up. So it's only about a minute.
You were saying something about Commissioner Elton's very smart, Adam.
No, you didn't hear that right. That was not there. That was definitely a distortion, okay? All right. Well, what I was saying is, let me back up again here, is, it was a focus, what did we see at the scene? And again, folks, if I start to break up, don't hesitate to stop me, because I mean, that's what we need to do is discuss all of this. But what I was saying is, what I believe brought this whole thing to the forefront was the inspector looks up, he does see this cable hanging, but that from my read of the evidence, he sees electrical tape. Now, that would get my attention, because to me, with electrical tape around a cable, that tells me that, is that a repair? What is that? And I need to take a look at it. And I believe that's what brought his attention here, as it hung from the roof. Now, at that point in time, as they're looking at this cable up on the roof, I believe the evidence is Consol safety inspector said he saw no damage at that point. There's no evidence at that point that there was any actual damage actually seen as this was hanging here on the roof. And the inspector also did testify that there was power on that cable at that time. So they're all looking at this thing. And from what I see in the evidence, again, they see some electrical tape up there. He sees it. He says, kill the power, which they did. Take the cable down off the J hooks, which they did. And my reading of the evidence is that's when he starts the inspection along that cable with his hands. And then he finds two areas of concern to him. Now, again, he's focused on this piece of electrical tape, which I think is in one of the pictures. I say that's what got his attention. Now, when he sees these two spots here, one of them is a 3/4 inch long area. And I believe ultimately now he doesn't find anything wrong with that. But apparently there's a 3/4 inch long area. It looks like a cut from what I can see that is described. But apparently there's no issue to that particular area. The other area, the 1 3/4 inch long, that's the area that I think that really drew the attention here. Now, it appears from the evidence from these two areas, now, both of them had cuts through the outer covering. I mean, that's the evidence. But I think the focus is on the second area where it looks to be deeper. Now, again, there's no evidence here that either one of those places were taped over or there was any type of repair that was attempted to those two areas. So what I see is you're looking up there, you got a piece of tape around this cable that gets your attention. You take it down. He does his hand inspection, finds two areas, two plain cuts in the outer covering, and they're not taped over. So they're open cuts is what it looks like to me from the evidence. Now, going back to that regulation, the plain language says it has to be adequately insulated and fully protected. Now, going back to our commission president, Harlan Cumberland, any damage to the outer jacket alone by that case plainly violates the requirement of the standard because the cable is not fully protected. And that's what the commission found in that case. So I have to say there is substantial evidence here to show that this is a violation based on those two cuts, not taped up, not repaired, that you found initially. Now, let's go to the S&S part. Is it S&S? And again, we got to go to Newtown Mathis analysis here. And under that, if we go to step one, as I
Marco, see, we're
there is a violation, so step one is satisfied.
It just
under started. Step two, okay?
It just started.
All right, let me back up, okay?
Only good. 5 seconds.
Stop me, all right? Okay, let me back up. What I was saying is we got step one under Newtown Mathis because I believe there is a violation here. So I think that gets us to step one. Now I'm focusing on step two. And again, is there reasonable likelihood occurrence of safety criteria? You losing me?
We are.
Very right. Intermittent.
All right. Let me see if I can't. I actually saw a little thing pop up, said unstable internet. So let me talk slow.
I've got a message, Marco. I've got a message that says Marco Rakovich network bandwidth is low.
Okay. All right. Let's see, what have I got here?
Marco, this is Christoph.
Yes.
We can also switch you over to phone audio, so you can remain in Zoom, but we can use the phone as the audio connection if that works better.
That's fine with me. What should I do then, Christoph?
I'm going to send you the call-in number and meeting ID and password, so give me about 2 seconds.
That's fine. Bear with me, folks. All right, let me go to my email then.
All right, you tell.
Oh, yeah.
Tell me what I need to do.
We can hear you, Marco, so we're good to go.
All right, I'm turning my volume all the way down because I did get a little feedback there. All right, so you can hear me?
Yes, sir.
All right, good deal. All right, what I was saying is the going now back to the plain language of the regulation, and is it S&S? Is there a reasonable, likelihood to cause the occurrence of the safety hazard? And again, I think when we do take a look at that standard, it requires that cable be fully protected. Now, how do we fully protect it? How is that accomplished, I guess, by this? Now, go to another regulation, 30 CFR 75901. Now, that mandates ground fault protection. Now, as I read these two together, that's a requirement for this cable, and it's not an option, and it's not a redundant protection that the operator chooses to supplement as an option. I mean, if the cable had no ground fault protection, that in and of itself would be a violation. It's not a lack of redundancy as I see this. Now, MSHA mandates, and this gets to the shock factor now is from my analysis here. MSHA mandates a 7.5 amp trip for that ground fault protection. Now that's the threshold that MSHA set for safety to prevent electrical shock. So if you've got the ground fault, which you have to by law, that's what the thing is set at by MSHA regulation. Now here, and the evidence was that the ground fault trip was actually set 25 times lower at 300 milliamps. Now, there's no dispute to that evidence in the record, and the facts do show that the power was on when the inspector first saw that cable. So to me, the unrebutted evidence is that the feeder and the cable had been examined the day before with no deficiencies noted. Now, I didn't see any evidence of ground fault problems with this feeder or this cable that was pointed out in the past. And I didn't see any evidence that any citations were issued either for inadequate examinations or for no ground fault system. So to me, there's substantial evidence that the ground fault was working. Now, as to the condition of these interleads, now, the judge stated that Consol presented no persuasive evidence that manipulating these power cables would cause the damage. In his opinion, though, he didn't reconcile the inspector's testimony or what the inspector actually did with the cable. An inspector testified that a finger or fingernail could cause the type of damage that he alleged existed here. And as to, we've talked about the inspector's handling of the cable, the judge called these vigorous manipulations that may have embellished the cable's opening. Now, the judge rejected the arguments, either expressed or implied in his words, that the inspector had deliberately or recklessly damaged the cable. But to me here, the intent of what the guy did is not the point to me. The point is whether there was existing damage or whether the inspector's own actions caused any damage to the inner leads. And I think that's the key here, because that's where you're going to get the connection, is if there's damage to these inner leads, to where you do get a connection and you do have a current flowing here. All right, now, I didn't see any, there was no substantial evidence to me as to whatever condition those leads were in, regardless of what caused it. I mean, the photos there, so what, to me then, Mathis and the Newtown step two, again, was there reasonably likelihood that the occurrence would create this discrete safety hazard? Now here, the unrebutted evidence is that the ground fault, as required by law, was working. So to me, there's no substantial evidence that the inner leads were exposed while that cable was hanging near the roof. And I don't see any substantial evidence that even if the inner leads were exposed, that they would have come into contact, or if there would have been some kind of current flow to override that ground fault and pose this hazard. So frankly, I don't see any substantial evidence supporting an S&S finding here. Now, moving on to negligence. The judge stated that the inspector testified that the operator knew or should have known of this volatile condition. But again, let's take back to the scene now here and the record evidence. As the cable was hanging visible on the roof, the inspector himself did not see any damage, and none particularly to those inner leads. Now, this cable was supported by J-hooks, and those hooks had a locking mechanism onto them to keep it up on the roof. Now, the evidence was that the inspector didn't see any significant damage here until after they took the cable down from the roof and after he manipulated it. Now, I think Consol's safety inspector testified he didn't see any damage. Now, here's where I would have to go back to the record again, but my reading of it is he didn't see any damage until after they took it down and after the inspector manipulated it. Now, the photographs, again, I take issue with the photographs. They did not show the condition of the cable as it existed before the inspector grabbed a hold of it. All right, so I didn't see any record evidence there of what those photographs showed. And again, the evidence was that the day before, when this cable was examined, it was found to be in good condition. Now, again, I didn't see any evidence of citations for inadequate examination here. So to me, there's no evidence that the inspector really ever discovered how this condition occurred as to what he found. He didn't know how long the condition had existed. He never spoke with any of the examiners or inquired into the examinations that were made to this feeder or the cable. As to the presence of other people, now this was the inspector's opinion. He talked about the Ram car drivers, and he even opined that as they travel in this area, it's hard for them to see the cable. So I think that's where I'm coming from, is the focus is what did they see? And here's a cable up on the roof. And the only thing that actually brought their attention was this piece of electrical tape wrapped around the thing initially. So I don't see any substantial evidence here about what was seen or what could have been seen about this cable in that regard. Didn't see any photographs about the area, exactly what it was. We saw a couple of photographs there, but I don't believe they were of the particular area that we're talking about. So I really don't see any substantial evidence to support a moderate negligence level here. Now, on the other hand, we do have evidence that there was dirt and rock dust on these two damaged areas that they did find once they took the cable down. Now, to me, that does indicate if you got damage on that outer covering and you've got embedded dirt or rock dust, that had to be there before the cable was put up on the roof and suspended on the roof. So I'm not convinced that there's no negligence here, since I think an argument could be made that that damaged outer covering now with the dirt, how'd the dirt get there? And then it's up on the ceiling. So I think we've got some problems there with the evidence there again, but at worst, I see this as low negligence. I can't be convinced that it's no negligence. Now, one side issue here is the Consol raised the issue of bias on the part of the judge in its reply brief. And I think that argument was couched in terms of credibility determinations. But now my focus here is on the unrebutted record facts. So I don't even get to, you know, the credibility of witnesses here. So to me, in summing all this up, I would affirm on the fact of the violation. I would reverse on S&S. I would reverse on the moderate negligence because I don't believe it's no more than low negligence. So now having said all of that, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues here for discussion. Can you still, first of all, can you still hear me pretty good? Or have you heard too much of
me? Very well. Yeah. Can you hear us?
Okay. Yes, I can.
Well, I guess I'll start off the discussion by saying our trainer's lucky unless he wants to spend the rest of his career being consecutively reappointed to the commission, because I find it would have been a big advantage to me doing trials if I'd had this position first, because you see how many times you say, why didn't they ask one more question and make this clear? They got really close, but they didn't go all the way, you know? And so it is difficult to sometimes to parse out what the testimony really meant when it stops one or two questions short of getting to the nub of the matter.
I had to learn that the hard way in practice a couple of times.
Yeah, well, that's exactly.
Amen.
Fortunately, I won't be, well, wait a second, I guess it's unfortunate I won't be having a long career trying cases. That's not a good thing, is it? But if you try cases, this will have been a very helpful learning experience as well as your own personal experience. However, there's several places here that I saw that, and in fact, I'll just mention a couple of them. It has to do with, first with, and Commissioner Traynor, I agree with you, I saw this, I wondered about this too. When the inspector said you have to do hand-over-hand inspection of the cable, did he mean if you see a problem, you have to hand-over-hand the area of the problem? Or did he mean that an adequate inspection means you've done hand-over-hand of the cable? I think we read it differently, and that's fine. That's, you know, because it's very possible he just said you should do hand over hand and stopped, but he didn't say the whole cable or just this section. And it's possible he meant just this section. I completely agree. That is a possible reading of his testimony, but we don't know for sure. He also seemed to be saying that if the weekly inspection had been done 5 days before, he might not have found negligence because this thing could have happened since the last inspection and it wouldn't have been found. I mean, there's testimony there about, well, if this had happened 3 or 4 days, but this was just a day before, but the inspection was just, the examination was just a day before. You're looking a little skeptical there, Art. I don't know.
No, I'm not. I'm just not familiar with what you're with what you're saying, that piece of evidence.
There's a portion of testimony, I think, where he talks about, well, this examination was just the day before. Now, it's like I'm saying, the testimony sort of trails off. It's sort of like, if this examination was just the day before, now, if it had been done 4 or 5 days before, and then it sort of stops, what does that mean if it was, why don't you keep going, you know? Yeah. But I sort of thought that he was saying, well, you maybe wouldn't have seen it if it had been four or five, if they found it, if the examination four or five, it could have been an intervening event that a the examination wouldn't have found it, you know?
I get it.
So the negligence would be different. I also agree that they've said a pinhole, just a pinhole can create a danger, but I'd like to know how we can really reasonably expect a mine examiner to find pinhole sticks into a thick, round, insulated can. That require almost a magnifying glass going down the length of the thing. I mean,
on that point, Commissioner Austin and Commissioner Traynor, the pinhole, I agree. But the thing is, too, that pinhole has to go all the way into that inner conductor. I mean, if you've got a pinhole on the outer jacket, there's no electrical connection there. I mean, and you got this ground fault in there. All right. But it's got to go all the way to that inner conductor. And you got to have that connection there where you've got the the electrocution factor, if that's what it is. So, you know, if you got a pinhole, but I agree with you got a pinhole. I mean, it's hard to find, particularly if it's in the dark, you know, but I'm not discounting any of that. But let's say you find it. That to me is when it requires a deeper inspection as to, all right, I got a pinhole here. Does that pinhole go all the way through the outer covering? Does it go into the inner leads? What does it do? Now, the big thing to me is, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Well, I was saying, if you had a pinhole, wouldn't the proper thing to be to simply tape it up and repair it just rather than
That's my whole point. And see, that's what I think got their attention. That's my reading of the evidence. I think that's what got their attention to start with. You got this cable, it's locked up to the ceiling here, all right? It's drooping down. I know there's testimony as to how far it was drooping down, but doesn't matter, it's drooping down. But I really do believe, if you read that testimony, what got their attention was this taped portion, which now goes to what you're saying, Commissioner Austin, is was it taped over a pinhole? Was it taped over a cut? What was it? So the guy takes it down to look at it. And you're right. I mean, if you got a pinhole, I mean, if you want to dig down in and see if it gets to the inner leads, you know, the thing is, if it trips that ground fault and you got no power in the cable, well, you know, you got ground, you know, but you're right. The repair of that, you would put tape around it, you know, if that's what you've got so that you've adequately covered that thing. But I think that's what really got their attention to start with is this one tape place. When they take the tape place down, they see these other two spots.
Well, it, one more point is with respect to the S&S, the inspector seemed to, and maybe I'm wrong about this, Commissioner Traynor, but say that the real S&S arose if a man trip or car carrying coal or whatever dislodged the cable, somebody might pick it up and put it back by hand. But unless I misunderstand the record, not only was it on a J-hook, but they were locked J-hooks. So I'm not seeing how a man trip would dislodge it and knock it to the floor if they're locked. And the inspector testified he didn't know they were locked. So the inspector missed an important fact relating to what he saw as the source of danger.
But on that point, and I'll also tell you that I don't have the record memorized here, but it was my understanding that the concern that a miner would grab the cable to replace it back on the guy, the J-hooks, stems from the fact that the cable was in fact hanging a few feet from the guy. And I could be wrong about that.
I just thought at that point he said it would be dislodged and go to the floor and they'd have to hang it. And it was a big struggle to get this cable off, you know. Let's
accept that as true. There's the other opportunity for miners to come into contact with a damaged cable would occur when this cable was handled while the equipment to which it was connected was being moved under power.
Do they turn it off while they do that? I don't know.
No, the testimony, it has to be under power because the cable's providing the power that the machine moves.
Yeah, they got to move it. But, and again, I don't want to get into evidence I don't want to get into my mind forming days, guys, but let me just say in general, all right, in general, you're right, Art. I mean, this thing, these feeders are on tracks and they're movable, all right? So to move that thing up, you're going to have power on it. But here's the thing, too, like a miner cable. As that miner cable moves, I mean, as that miner, continuous miner moves, it's got a trailing cable. It's got a cable on it. And they literally pick that up and move the cable as that miner is moving. Now, here's the thing is, you know, if you want to look at it, they all got their, they all should have all their electrical gloves when they're handing these cables. So I guess here's what I'm saying in practicality and in general terms. When they get ready to move that ratio feeder up, you're right, they got to have power on it. Now, if that cable has a short in it, it trips that ground fault, kills the power. If not, while they're moving it, what they should be doing, and I know we can talk about what they should be and what they actually do sometime, and we're looking at worst case in it, but what they should be doing, they should be handling those cables with gloves, all right? So I guess I go back again to this ground fault thing. You know, MSHA set the level to prevent electrical shock, and this thing was 25 times lower than that. So, you know, even if they were moving this cable up with power on it, all right, I don't see the hazard myself. That's me.
Well, I'll just make one more point and shut up. And that is on my suggestion that I might go no negligence. I think based on the evidence that Colby saw some, I forget the word, is it distortion or damage there? He saw something.
He said he felt bumps. He felt bumps. Is what way I read in the record.
Based upon that, later on, he said, of course, it's a violation when he saw the interlead after the manipulation, but just based on the bumps, I would ordinarily find this to be a violation. Honestly, my thought of no violation is a sanction against the inspector's manipulation of the evidence. It's a sanction. It would be to teach Inspector Yates or MSHA inspectors generally, when a mine representative is with you, you don't manipulate the evidence, clean it, change it, and then show it to the miner's representative. You just don't do that. Inspector Yates is a little too zealous. I like good inspectors. They should be zealous. And if he saw something that made him think we should check this cable, God bless him for doing it. That's a good thing. That's not a bad thing. But he went too far when you start tapping the, hitting it with a stick, twisting it, picking at it with a screwdriver, and then saying, oh yeah, look, now this lead, look at that lead in there. It would be a straight out, I would couch it as a sanction against MSHA for the indeliberate, not deliberate. I'm criticizing Inspector Yates heavily, but I'm not saying he deliberately did anything wrong. He's a very zealous inspector, which is good. A little too zealous in my mind.
Especially with respect, I can understand an increased amount of zealousness from any inspector inspecting this particular mine where there had been inspecting power cables in this because there had been numerous issues, and Yates himself had identified numerous violations of this standard. And so he saw, okay, there's a systemic problem here. They are just not putting forth the resources necessary to ensure their cables are properly shielded. And that's why I think, that's why I could go high negligence on this based on that almost disregard for the systemic nature of a failure to identify repeat violations.
Two things on that point. I think much of his zealotry, because he talked about this more than anything else, was his own personal bad experience with electricity, since he was nearly killed by being electrocuted. That would make you pretty zealous on electricity. Sure. I agree with you.
Sure. No question.
Now I'm very careful getting in and out of the tub. So I understand that made him very zealous, and I don't want to over-criticize him, but on the negligence point, and if you found it, suppose he'd been looking around and now he didn't find these cuts, but looking down, he said, oh, what is that? Hey, that's a pinhole. That's a pinhole. Damage the outer cable. These guys have lots of violation. High negligence.
No, that the fact that it's a pinhole would go to how reasonable it was that they didn't discover it, right?
Right. That would go to the negligence, though, wouldn't it? That they hadn't found it. And so, anyway, I don't know. At some point, we've got to talk about what we're going to decide here. I guess I could go with the violation and low negligence, since the difference between no negligence and low negligence is, in a practical real world, nothing. If that's necessary to get to a decision, I would like to sanction MSHA for the misconduct of the inspector. Undeliberate, overzealous misconduct, I stress. But a sanction is probably not necessary. So in any disturbance of the outer thing, even the pinhole is a violation. So, you know, violation, but so I don't know where we are on this, but I would go no S. I'd be willing to go low negligence. I think the chairman indicated low negligence, no S and S. I would move to that position. Violation, no negligence, S and S. I'd move to that position. I don't know that I'd go to that position necessarily on all the grounds the chairman said. I don't find it necessary to get into the redundant safety measure issue probably here to get to low negligence and not S&S, because we don't know it's S&S because we don't know what it was really like before he may have changed the evidence.
You know, let me say one last thing, and again, where I'm coming from with this thing on what the operator should have seen, saw, whatever, all right, and the inspection and all. And again, I'm trying not to draw from a background here, but at least throw in some general terms here. What I think you had on this feeder is, again, you had this cable, and obviously where that cable comes from the power center, and I'm guessing here now, because this is not in evidence. You got the connection into the power center. Now here's the cable, all right? And the cable is strung along, whether it's hung entirely over the roof, whether it's curled up along the rib at the bottom, one way or the other, the cable's got to get over to the feeder. All right, the cable's plugged into the power center. Now, from what I think the real point of contention here is, when that cable was apparently on the ceiling over top of the loading point, going down to the ratio feeder, that's where it was supported by the J hooks, and I don't know if some or all were locked. It sounds like that there was a locking mechanism. I don't mean like a key in a lock, master lock, but there was some sort of locking mechanism for the J hook to where it just would not, you know, jump out of that hook. Now I agree with what Art said. You got the cable's hanging down. Something happened. I don't know what happened, but you got a loop down there. I don't know how far up from the top, but now let me cross trail where my point is here. So when you're looking at an inspection, now when they inspect this cable, are they going to go and take that entire cable down off the J hooks, lay it down on the ground, and hand over hand feel for loops? Now that's not in evidence. I doubt seriously that was what happened or in practice, and I'm not advocating that that's what they should do, because if you think about it, when they inspect all this equipment, I don't believe that they, like, take the miner cable, for example, when they're doing an electrical inspection on it, I don't think that they go hand over hand the entire length of that cable, and I think there's some 700 feet to that thing, if I recall, hand over hand, trailing it all the way back to the power center. I think the first thing they do is see if it's kicked or if it's tripped at the breaker. So I guess what I'm saying, inspecting on cables is, once you find it, now we got a different ballgame. Once you find a problem, I agree, you need to look at it and, you know, go whatever you need to do, take it down hand over hand, whatever it is. But as this cable was strapped up to the roof with these J hooks and with hooked in, I don't think a normal inspection would have been, the procedure would have been, take it all down, and let's do hand over hand all the way to the feeder. I don't think that's what's happening. That's why I'm taking evidence for what it is, well, what did they see? They saw it up on the roof. And again, to me, I don't want to beat a dead horse here, but what got everybody's attention was this piece of tape, which to me would have indicated you got a pinhole, you got a cut or something. Yeah, let's take a look at that thing, all right, which is what the inspector did. So anyway, that's where I'm coming from as far as the inspection goes. So I'll shut up on that point.
Well, on that point, again, I don't want to beat my dead horse either, but I'll mention again that I'm looking at that evidence of exactly what kind of inspection was done, what kind of inspection should have been done in these circumstances. I'm looking at one very important circumstantial fact, that this mine had a repeat problem with damaged cables and was on notice that it should redouble its efforts and give these electrical inspections some additional scrutiny. And so I have to think further about how that cuts with what you were saying, but it's a very important factor in my mind that
understood.
It's very a different situation if you're in a mine that hasn't had a history of problems, because then the reasonable duty of care may be to, for example, only inspect areas where you can see damage with a visual inspection, or where there is some indication that there's a ground fault. Because there's been a trip, something like, maybe the level of care under that circumstance where you don't have a systemic problem is a little bit lower. And so that those two things interrelate quite a bit for me on that question. Well, and just to come back to where I am in terms of, I don't think I will join you, my colleagues, in reversing the judge on S&S. And I expect a lot of what I would write in a dissenting opinion on that point would be fairly straightforward in what you would expect to see with an emphasis on substantial evidence. There are a lot of different calls on a lot of different issues we've discussed. And of course, their substantial evidence test and evaluation looks not to necessarily, as Marco pointed out, what we would have decided ourselves, but whether there was some reasonable basis for that decision that the judge made. On negligence, my first reading and the discussion we've had today leaves me at affirming the judge on moderate negligence. But as I mentioned to Commissioner Alton earlier, I'd like to look more closely at the facts as they relate to each of these issues that you two brought up, because I didn't have all of those issues in mind when I did my first run through. I haven't heard anything that would change my position, but I want to take a second look. But that's where I am right now, is affirming along the lines of the memo.
All right, I'll make a final comment. Is we've almost talked about this violation as if it was for an inadequate inspection. yet there's no citation for that. And I think there's a lot, I understand, and I thought a lot about Commissioner Traynor's position, which is understandable because that's where the lack of additional testimony leaves you a little wondering a little bit, because if the inspector had been clear that, well, I saw what I thought was damage to this cable. He says, I think he's saying, but I saw something that might have indicated it might have been damaged. And if he said, so I just inspected that part of the cable, and that's why I went hand over hand there, so you weren't implying, which because I think the chairman is clear, we can't imply that you got to do hand over hand of all cables in the mine at all times to do an adequate inspection, or you're negligent. If he hadn't, there's support for Commissioner Traynor's position. I don't dismiss that out of hand at all. I thought about that a lot. So I just wanted, I for what it's worth, I completely understand your position. I have no problem whatsoever with your position.
And just one other thing. Again, I'm not arguing with either one of you, but something just occurred to me too. I want us to be pretty clear on this, just I guess from the evidence standpoint and maybe from a practical standpoint, when we're talking about hand-over-hand inspection of the cable, frankly, now think about it. If that thing is strapped, here's where I'm coming from. The hand-over-hand that was done here, as I read the evidence, was after the cable was taken down from the roof to where you could definitely get your hand all the way around that cable. Now, you think about it, if it's strapped to the roof, hand over hand doesn't do you a whole lot. I mean, because you're only going to get what's not exposed to the roof. So if you're really going to do a hand over hand deal and you know, test that cable all the way around, you got to have it down in your hand. So I don't think the hand over hand inspection was as the cable was strapped to the roof.
Oh, no.
If it had been, I'd say, guys, you're not inspecting the cable hand over hand if you're not grabbing all the way around it. So just point of clarification from my point on this cable thing, regardless of however it fits in here. But
we can't apply adequate inspection of that cable. You have to unlock all the J hooks, take it down all the way the length, and have a guy go down hand over hand. That's completely unrealistic.
I don't know about that though, Bill. I'm not sure that is an unreasonable expectation, again, given knowledge of a recurring problem. And here, the analysis would be different if this is a cable that was always locked in these J hooks and remained in these J hooks. But my understanding of the record testimony is that the cable is regularly taken down and handled by miners when the machinery is moved.
I don't know.
Right. So,
right. Art, I see.
You have to take my representations of the record with a grain of salt because they come off the top of my head. I'm not looking and citing a particular page, but I think this is a cable that would be regularly handled by miners. And so whether it would be, whether it would be negligent not to do a hand-over-hand inspection given that circumstance,
I don't even know.
I have to think about it a little bit more. But I just bring that up to say it's a different situation between a hanging cable and a cable. Yeah,
I understand.
I see. One other point of clarification. Again, Art, I didn't see anything in the record on this. All right, and I know where you're coming. I think what you're saying is, with the record that the mine had, they should have been doing a more thorough inspection. It sounds like what you're saying. Now, as far as the frequency, let me put it this way, as the frequency of how these cables are handled in general, again, and here I go again, all right, but in general, because I didn't see this in the record, but now think about this. When you've got that feeder, that's the loading point, all right, for everything that comes to that one point. That feeder is not going to be moved up constantly during the shift at all. In fact, because it's stationary, that's the loading point. So that's the reason why I believe they had the J hooks coming across the ceiling. So they've got to, in other words, that loading point is there. So they established the cables over to it, hung it from the roof, and pretty much got it in place, let's say. All right, now, that feeder is not going to be constantly moving during the shift, obviously, all right? But you're right. It will move up as that whole section advances. Now, here's where we don't have evidence. How often is that? I doubt seriously that it was every shift. I doubt seriously that it was every day. I don't know, because that depends on the rate of advance, you know, but your minor cable, your Boulter cable, different. I mean, that stuff's constantly moving all the time, all right? But now here's on the far other end. I know the power center, definitely is in place for a pretty good long period of time because they just don't need to move that, you know? So yeah, that is very infrequently. You're not going to be handling that cable, you know, much. But I think the feeder is not something that's going to be moved that frequently, but you're right. It will be moved as the place advances up. So
periodically, we would say, but we don't know the period.
Periodically. There you go. And we don't know. We don't have the evidence. We don't know what it is. So let me try to summarize, because I know Rory's probably ripping his hair out here. Like, well, how am I going to write this, that, and the other? But let me see if I've got this right. To start with, on the fact of a violation, now I know Commissioner Austin, I know you had some problems there and with the inspector and all, but are we all in agreement that it is a violation, or where are you on that?
I'm willing to go with a violation because I think there's enough evidence that there was a disruption of the cable so that the cable was not maintained per the regulation. I simply can't countenance the way the inspector, so it would be an adverse inference in order to teach him a lesson, but I can go with violation.
All right. Now on SNS, I think where we have two commissioners would reverse on that. And I think what we're looking at is another new Commissioner Traynor would probably address that in a dissent on that part. Is that correct?
Correct.
All right. Then I think the negligence then is something that, obviously that would be addressed in your dissent. And I think the negligence part, now, again, I'll go to you, Commissioner Austin. I don't know where we are on that. I don't see no, but that's me. But now where are you on that part?
Thinking, because we have to get to
you. Okay.
We have to get to it. Well, wait a second. You'd go low. Commissioner Traynor would go moderate. And if I went no, we wouldn't have a commission decision on negligence.
Hey, sounds like a
Traynor would, if Commissioner Traynor would go to low, I could go no. Except he wants to go high.
I would affirm in this case on substantial evidence. If I were deciding it myself, I would probably be inclined. Of course, I want to look at the record, as I said, all caveats. I'd
Understood.
Probably be inclined to certainly explore the possibility of high, but in this case, I would just affirm under substantial evidence that the judge drew the right conclusion from these facts and finding moderate.
Well, I actually go back over the testimony because I didn't think the inspector did sort of imply that if the weekly examination had been 4 days before, he might not have found it. But anyway.
That's something I need to look for. I didn't see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I probably, just because it's not going to make a big difference in the operators, because it would make a big difference in their violations. I probably, just because we've got to get to at least two people agreeing, I probably could go low negligence. For purposes of Rory, I'll go low negligence and look at the draft decision. Rory writes the majority and then he writes the dissent.
Is that okay with you all? He is my counsel, so we're helping with the dissent now. Rory deserves quite a bit.
That's fine.
He doesn't write all.
Hey, Rory. You too, buddy. Come on now. You're our guy. Come on, Rory. Give us a big smile. Thumbs up.
Yeah. I mean, it wouldn't be the first time, so I'm fine with doing it.
I know.
I figure so.
That's actually the art of being a really good lawyer, which Rory is.
That's right. Very lucky to have him.
Well, let me turn to you now, Rory. Have you heard enough to kind of tell you where we're going with all this now?
Yes. I'm going to write a majority decision, finding the violations supported by substantial evidence. And I'm going to find that we're going to reverse the SNS, and we're going to reverse his negligence determination and find low negligence. And then we'll circulate that and see where we go.
Yeah, and then we'll kind of go from there then.
Sure.
Sound good to everybody?
Does.
All right. Anybody got anything else? Rory, you want to shoot us?
No, I'm good. We finished before 12, so.
Okay. All right. Good enough. Well, yep. I guess then, folks, if there's nothing else, then let's just go ahead and conclude the meeting then. Thanks very much to everybody.